is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome David McCloskey, the author of a work of fiction, a novel, Damascus Station. It is a story of intrigue involving state security in the United States, state security in the Middle East, especially Syrian state security, Mukhbarat. However, this is based upon historical events that in these last years have become more and more tragic. So we begin with David's presentation of the conditions where he puts his characters in and asks them to solve puzzles that are still unavailable to all of us in the tragedy of the darkness visible of Syria. Millions have fled, hundreds of thousands may be dead. Assad remains at the palace in Damascus. This is a story of what was possible early in the turmoil, early in the collapse of Syrian sovereignty. David, congratulations and a very good evening to you. Your hero, protagonist, Sam Joseph, is a CIA officer, a covert officer. He is plunged into the conditions in Syria. He knows this very well. He's a veteran. So let us introduce what Sam knows he's up against when he arrives in Damascus at the CIA operations in Damascus. Bashar al-Assad, what is he as your novel opens, and what is his ambition, his contest as your novel opens? Good day to you, David.
John, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here talking with everyone and you about Damascus Station. The book starts in page one. It says it's the early years of the Syrian uprising, which is really when I looked at this as an analyst at the CIA. And, you know, it's a work of fiction. There's not a year on there, but this is really looking at the world of Syria, the CIA, the Middle East, from about 2011 to 2013, which is when we had the beginnings of a protest movement in Syria. We had the initial spark of kind of insurgency. We had the beginnings of state crackdown and eventually sort of full-on counterinsurgency against this opposition. And the main players that I introduce into this book are, on the one hand, the CIA, keen to understand what's going on inside the palace, how Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, is thinking about the unrest, what he plans to do to suppress it. And on the other hand, really the Syrian regime, which I paint the picture of that palace and its, you know, security apparatus through the eyes of several characters in this novel, one of whom is Sam's eventual recruit, Miriam Haddad, who's a kind of ambivalent palace official who is trying to do her job, but also very frustrated and angry about family being mistreated, not uncommon in Syria at the time. And also through the eyes of several Syrian security officials, one named Ali Hassan, who is also an ambivalent sort of former police detective focused on cracking down on the protesters, finding spies. And so I really wanted to paint, I think, in the story of this novel, a scene of a country, the city, Damascus itself, sort of on the verge of the fall right before it tipped over into full-on state collapse.
Yes, it begins in 2011, coterminous with the Arab Spring. It might be a result of the Arab Spring, but that isn't critical. What is to understand Bashar al-Assad, trained as an ophthalmologist, married to a fashionable woman, and as comfortable in Paris as he is anywhere else in the world. And yet the man you present in the course of the novel, who survives and continues, is as bloody-minded as we can imagine Djugashvili Stalin was once upon a time. You've presented a genuine force of nature. You've also presented the fact that Bashar al-Assad makes at least one phone call to Vladimir Putin. What do we need to know about the relationship between Moscow and Damascus?
Yeah, I did have a lot of fun putting the real Bashar al-Assad, a fictional interpretation of him, and Vladimir Putin into this book. To have a little bit of fun at their expense, which they, so richly deserve. The Russians and Syrians have a longstanding relationship that goes back to well into the Cold War, when Syria was a client state They purchased most of their military equipment from Moscow. They were firmly in the Soviet camp during the Cold War. That tailored off a bit, obviously, or tapered off a bit during the 90s. But as Bashar consolidated power in the early 2000s after his father died and he took the reins in Syria, the Russians, and especially as the Arab Spring erupted and his rule was challenged, the Russians saw him as a way to achieve some very specific objectives in the Middle East. They wanted access to a warm water port on the Mediterranean. They now have that. They wanted to prop him up as a way to, you know, contest with us globally because we were opposed to him. And as a result, the personal relationship between Putin and between Assad, you know, most people don't think is particularly close. There are, you know, deep strategic reasons why the Russians have invested so heavily in the Syrians over the past, 10 years, and certainly in the past five or six or so, when they, underwent a more full-throated military intervention that, by most accounts, probably saved the regime from collapsing in 2015 and 2016.
Complicating this is the fact that these are historical events. They're dim in my memory, but we lived through them without any clarity. And you were an analyst at the CIA, and you know what the fog of war is. So I add one more complication. During this period between the Arab Spring, 2011, and 2013, when the question of Assad using WMD, the U.S. left Iraq. The decision was to leave Iraq. And then again, the decision by the executive was to confront Assad over his use of WMD. And the president was Barack Obama in this period. And he's presented as a man making decisions that are helpful to the CIA, but have their limits, always their limits. What do you want us to understand about the interest of the U.S. involved in all this? I understand it's virtuous to protect people from sarin gas. But in any event, how were we entangled in this period? How was the U.S. entangled with Assad, with eventually Putin? And then, of course, we could go around, ring around the world of the Middle East. What was our interest, David? What national security interest?
Yeah, well, I think early on in the Arab Spring, when regimes were sort of tottering all around the region, Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Libya, all of this was happening at the same time as Syria. And there was a sense, I think, on the part of many in the administration at the time, that the fall of Assad was inevitable. It was not a matter of if, it was a matter of when. And that when was thought to be fairly short. So as a result, made a lot of rhetorical statements about how he should go. And that was the, right thing for U.S. policy. It was the right thing sort of, from a value standpoint, that Assad step down and allow a political transition to occur. When that didn't happen, we began to explore as a government options to support opposition against him. And when that opposition didn't really materialize in a unified, coherent way, the opposition to him has always been fairly particularly in that period, very fragmented. We were on the one hand left with, statements around how he should go, warnings about not using chemical weapons for fear that that would create precedent in other places that they could be used. And then on the other hand, this sort of, I would say less than full-throated support for the opposition emerging against him. And so when sarin was used in dramatic fashion in 2013, and by the way, it had been used at a very small scale starting in 2012. But when it was used in massive scale in 2013, we were sort of stuck with this problem whereby we had a tremendous gap between where our rhetoric was and between the resources that we were truly willing as a country to commit to achieve the objectives that we had set out for ourselves. And I think whenever you have that kind of gap, it's a recipe for policy disaster. And I think that is what unspooled when we decided not to respond in at least some kind of punitive way to the use of chemical weapons in August of 2013.
One more historical figure in the book that is not present but referred to, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father. You make very clear that this scale of massacre has happened before in Syria. You talk about the massacre in 1980s and the tribal warfare in Syria between the Alawites, the minority that the Assad family represents, the Christians, the Sunnis, and eventually al-Qaeda crowds in, the jihadists. So what we're dealing with here is a battleground state. Is that correct, David? That's the way you want the reader to understand it. This state has been at war for a long time.
Well, I think that is certainly true over the past 10 years in the way that this protest movement and then insurgency and then civil war has developed. The state, though, previously went through an insurgency, as you mentioned, in the early 80s, which was fought between largely the kind of militant wing of the Muslim Brotherhood in the country, Sunni Muslims, and the largely Alawite-dominated security apparatus and military led by the Assad family. That was suppressed violently in 1982. It was put down. And in the intervening period from the mid-80s until the Arab Spring, the state was not at war, but the state was not sort of put together politically in the way that we would think most countries, most healthy or stable countries would be. It's a, country that was led by a very authoritarian regime that sort of managed a divide and rule strategy amongst the population. It had a highly repressive security apparatus, and it was a very patchwork country, similar in many respects to places like Iraq and Lebanon, where you had Alawites, 10% of the population, Christians were 10% of the population, Kurds were 10% of the population, Sunni Arabs made up the remainder. So you had this very patchwork, society from an ethnic and religious standpoint that when the Arab Spring began, made it challenging as sort of state authority weakened to maintain control of the entire entity.
I'm speaking to David McCloskey, a former analyst at the CIA for the Middle East, but now a novelist. And the new work of fiction is Damascus Station. This is the story of the CIA. And when we come back, we're going to tell what we want to, just a very limited amount of the setup of this thriller. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with David McCloskey, former CIA analyst for the Middle East, now a novelist, a thriller novelist. It's a spy novel. It's a profile of the Middle East as we lived through it these last 10 years. And with no clarity, many of the instances in David's book are extremely convincing. Anything can happen in Damascus. Our hero is named Sam Joseph. David presents him as a man from Minnesota who has a talent for gambling, probably has a gambler's weaknesses, doesn't know when to leave the table. He quickly establishes himself as a man who makes a mistake as a CIA officer. He falls in love with his asset. David, this is such a violation of what I know to be the CIA's recommendations about how you handle assets. I was charmed right away. My goodness, Sam, you don't deserve to be an officer very long. What do you want the readers to know about Sam's temptation and about Miriam?
Yeah, well, you hit a lot of the high points there, John. I mean, he is he is not out of the Ivy League. He is a pretty quote unquote normal guy when he is recruited to join the agency. He's a Midwesterner. He's had a spell in Vegas. He is very good at reading people and understanding their motivations. He's lived, I think, a life sort of outside of the profiles of many case officers that get recruited out of more elite universities, where he's been out in the world doing things. So he's a bit of a salt of the earth guy. He makes mistakes, as you mentioned, violates one of the cardinal rules of espionage and falls into a forbidden relationship with an asset. As I was writing the story, I liked that about him because it felt like everybody makes big mistakes. And so, having a book written about one that you make isn't so bad. He is I think throughout the book, a good case officer in the sense that he is very good at recruiting people and running operations, but a bad one in the sense that he has violated this, you know, key kind of ethical point that, that all case officers would ascribe to. His asset, Miriam, is a Syrian palace official who is from a very prominent Damascene Christian family. Her, you know, brothers and uncles and her father all have positions inside the government. So, you know, and they're of course fairly well off. So she's vested in the government. She's vested in the country. But her very rebellious cousin, with whom she is quite close, is or supports the opposition and has gone to a few protests. And when the book opens, I don't think I'll be giving anything away here. It happens quite quickly. When the book opens, her cousin is brutalized at one of those protests by a member of the Mukhabarat, the Syrian security services. And so this sets Miriam down a path of, on the one hand, understanding that her entire world is sort of knitted into this government. And on the other, this I think this burning desire for revenge and to free herself in some way from a cage that she perceives herself to be living in. And so when Sam and the CIA arrive at her doorstep, metaphorically speaking, she is sort of primed to enter this relationship with him and to provide secrets. And it also doesn't hurt that they both really, you know, enjoy each other, are attracted to one another, and eventually over the course of the book, fall in love.
There's a lot of revenge tale in this. Revenge of the CIA against the Mukhabarat. Revenge of the Alawites against the Muslim Brothers. Revenge of the Russians against the Americans. One character is more compelling than any other once you know the story. So we will not go farther with the story. We will just talk of Ali Hassan. What a good, bad man he is, David.
Yeah, he is the... Ali Hassan is President Assad's spy catcher. He is a very senior official inside the Syrian Mukhabarat. He is a former police detective and a family man who, in the opening scenes of this book, can be pictured at the same time roughly interrogating and torturing a prisoner and playing with his children at home and having dinner with his wife and family. So he is a man who is complicated. He does not like the government, though. And he is ambivalent, I think, very deeply about how the protest movement and the uprising should be dealt with and his own position in that. And so he is I think of all the characters in the book, many of whom are sort of caught between these, you know, dueling emotions and sort of pulls. I think more than any, he is probably the most trapped between what he wishes his life would be and what it is.
Let's go to tradecraft, David, when we come back, because there's a deal of tradecraft in here, and the CIA has approved David's novel. So we'll learn something. Damascus Station, David McCloskey, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with David McCloskey. His novel, Damascus Station, a work of fiction. A work of fiction about Syria in the early part of the second decade of the 21st century. A state that is completely collapsed now, a failed state. And yet, David takes us inside Syria, inside Damascus, and shows us what the CIA comes up against dealing with state security, Mukhabarat. And the FSB shows up. That's right. The reawakened KGB shows up. Other players include the Muslim Brothers, who have their own operation over the years, and then eventually the jihadists will show up. There's a great deal of tradecraft in David's book, and I recommend especially talking about it because David has passed his book to General David Petraeus, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, along with his other titles, and Leon Panetta, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, along with his other titles. They have read and approved And David also makes note in a post note that the CIA read his book very carefully several times, many more times, the Publication Review Board, and has approved what David has identified as tradecraft. So, David, I want to have some fun because we're not going to give the story away. We've indicated there's a hero and a heroine and a good bad guy, and we know who the villains are. What is an SDR, David? What do we learn from that right away at the opening scenes in Paris?
Sure. An SDR is the acronym for a surveillance detection route. It is one of the primary tools in the toolbox of any CIA case officer. It's also, in most spy novels, something that makes, it doesn't make very many appearances in most modern spy thrillers. It is essentially the act of plotting very carefully a route, stops, a series of moves on the street of a city as you are going to meet with an asset, whereby the combination of all of those different moves allow you to understand if you are being watched by the security services, typically of the state in which you find yourself. And so in my book, there are SDRs that occur on the streets of Damascus, so that when Sam is going to meet Miriam, for example, or getting to another safe house, he can determine if the Syrians are watching. And if the Syrians are watching, he can abort and go home or continue the route and then go home. So I think this is one of the key misconceptions about surveillance detection routes, is that they're not intended to lose surveillance, which would signal to the surveillant that you are in fact operational. They're intended to determine if you are being watched. And if you're being watched, you move along with your evening or your day, and you do not meet with the asset, clearly. But once you determine that you are being watched, or if you're not being watched, then you go and have the meeting and conduct the operational act.
Our hero and his allies, the Banditos, the brothers, they're wonderful characters. Think of an extremely AI canine, and you have an example of what the Banditos can do. They train Miriam in SDR. They use a drone. What kind of drone, David? What do we imagine? It was magical, and Miriam couldn't quite shake it. What does the drone do for them?
Well, in my fictionalized account, is Miriam is being trained in southern France in all manner of tradecraft to prepare her to go back into Damascus. A crew of Syrian support assets, codenamed the Banditos, help to train her alongside Sam, and they use a micro drone to do that. One of the reasons why I included that in the story was to make it so that it is far more complicated for Miriam as she's conducting her SDR through Nice, in this case, to get black, which is what we would call when you know that you're not being watched. It's also, I didn't include many details on that drone, but obviously the world of technology that is available today, be it drones, be it the proliferation of surveillance cameras, has made those operational acts, surveillance detection, much more difficult. And I wanted to include some flavor of that in my book.
Yes. And you've used the term already. What is a safe house? How does it function? And why is there more than one of them in any operational zone?
Yeah. So safe house would simply be a place that typically a CIA-owned or rented property that you would use to meet agents or assets. And in my book, there's a wide variety of safe houses, some of which are quite luxurious, others are quite run down, and they could range from the inconspicuous to the not so inconspicuous. But the point being that, it is hidden from public view who actually owns that place, and it's accessible by the CIA and its agents. In any given operational location, be it Italy, be it France, be it Syria, again, fictional world of the book, you would need multiple, because you would not want multiple assets to know that there's a particular location. You wouldn't share that information between assets. So there would be a safe house or set of safe houses used by one asset and a set of safe houses or locations used by another, so not as to contaminate those two assets, who would never know that the other existed, of course.
What is a dead drop, David?
Yeah, so if you think about how does the agency communicate with its sources, any connection between a CIA officer and an asset face-to-face is extremely, it's risky because you are proving in that moment to the host country that that person has a covert relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. And so limiting direct communication when possible between sources and the CIA is advisable. And so one of the methods of tradecraft that's been developed over the past, century, starting with the British up to today with the agency, is a dead drop whereby there's a prearranged known location where the case officer, let's say, can put something. In this case, in my book, it's a fairly innocuous piece of trash that's been fabricated so it can hold documents. The case officer may go up there, put something in there, and then 2 days later, the asset may come by and also remove that or put something in there. And so it allows the separation of the case officer and the asset to limit the risk that they're taking on when they're trying to communicate.
And a brush pass, how does that work?
Brush pass would be riskier in many respects, but a similar concept whereby if the case officer needs to pass something quickly to the asset, they may actually, it's kind of what it sounds like. They brush past each other in a public place, usually, predetermined or prearranged so that it's hidden from cameras and it's going to be hard for anyone watching them to have a good vantage point on this. But it allows them to very carefully pass, information or an envelope or a bag or something between two people in public as they go by each other. They won't acknowledge the other person. They won't speak. They'll move very quickly and fluidly in a very trained way, but it allows them to exchange that information quickly, in public and limit the exposure that they have and the time that they have together.
And an emergency signal, why and how is it used and what's it look like?
Yeah. In my book, the emergency signals are a little bit of vintage Cold War. We've got chalk on the walls in Damascus. And the reason for these is that, quite simply, if you have most forms of covert communication, and I'm putting aside a lot of the tech, the kind of the stuff we're talking about, brush passes and dead drops, they're inherently inefficient. There's a real lag in the asset's ability to communicate to the CIA or vice versa. An emergency signal allows for that asset to, in this case, mark up a wall. The agency has somebody that may not even exactly know why they're looking for this, go around the neighborhood on a regular basis to check if an emergency signal has gone up. And if it has, that initiates a protocol around, getting the asset out of the country or going to a safe house or something like that, so that it happens really quickly.
There is an operation planned by the CIA in the book where they're using face recognition, an algorithm named Molly, all caps, and an operation right up to the limit of execute or not execute. Face recognition using satellites or drones. That is inherently uncertain. We have most recently the incident in Kabul at the close of the American deployment, where the decision was made to shoot. I believe they used a drone, but it's not confirmed. And the U.S. government is now apologizing and paying reparations what it can with a family very badly damaged. So to your understanding, using that algorithm, using that face recognition, is it trusted by the agency when they're trying to identify either a target or a risk?
Well, I think, it's one of the reasons why in my novel, in the operation that you're discussing, the senior officials back at Langley in the Near East Division are so keen to have two eyes on the target, so to speak. They have, on the one hand, the cameras, in this case, that are going to compare the face that they're seeing against the agency's databases. In this case, it's a, it's an official, without giving too much away, the agency is looking at an official on whom they have some information so they can compare those photos and the video with what they're seeing in real time. But then also having the actual eyes of a case officer looking at this person in Damascus, and both of those things, you know, being sort of compared against one another to confirm that, you know, you actually do have the right target. So I wanted, you know, for a variety of different reasons, some of them related to the plots of the novel I was trying to construct. In my world, the CIA has, you know, this kind of fail safe of they've got eyes on target, and they also have Molly, in this case, the, you know, the AI driven facial recognition software that that allows them to be certain.
What can go wrong and why? You have an example in Sam's mind when he's most concerned about the operation blowing up. You refer to an operation that took place in Ankara during the Cold War, in which the Russians, then the opponents, who are very, very good, and this is their world, the Russians stumble upon or chance upon a CIA officer meeting an asset. What goes wrong, David?
Yeah, and this it's a fictional example, but it's based on a number of true stories. In my book, there's the case officer Sam is in the middle of an SDR, and he is thinking that he's black, but he's not sure. And as he's getting into this, mind games start in his head. He's concerned, and he's thinking back to this story around a CIA case officer who was in Ankara, who was running a Russian asset and who went through an extensive SDR, met with the asset, and then a few days later, the asset was in fact rolled up by the Russians, taken back to Moscow and shot. And in this case, what the Russians had done was they had built a bubble around the CIA case officer, meaning that they had extensive fixed and mobile surveillance assets on the ground in Ankara that allowed them to create a perimeter around him such that he never came into contact with them. And so never knew that they were there, but they watched him the whole time, this case officer, the Russians did, until he had his meeting with the asset. And so in my story, what Sam does is he basically has a street method that he employs where he breaks the bubble, meaning he shoots directly, you know, out of the range of where he's been walking and moving at great speed in a taxi, to force the Russians and Syrian teams in Damascus to redeploy around him. And in that movement, in that, you know, hasty movement, is when he, as the case officer, is going to pick up that he is being watched. And so I wanted to both nail in those scenes as much as I could the mechanics of that dance, but also the way that mentally it would feel as a case officer to be worried that, you know, what they would call seeing ghosts. Am I seeing ghosts? Am I imagining that there's surveillance out there? Sort of the case officer equivalent of the yips in baseball.
David McCloskey, he is the author of the new book, Damascus Station. It is a work of fiction based upon tragedy. When we come back, lessons learned writing about a tragedy that is unfinished. The WMD, the Assad regime, now seen in glory by its allies sitting in Damascus. And what are the lessons learned about writing a thriller that is so heartbreaking? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with David McCloskey. His work of fiction, a novel, is a thriller. CIA thriller, you could say, but it's a thriller of modern Syria. Unfinished business. Damascus Station, praised by David Petraeus, praised by Leon Panetta. But then again, they were in office during this period where there was nothing to be done with the scale of tragedy. There is horror in your book, David, and you mean it to be there, because what I know of reporting about Syria these many years, the Syrian regime, the Mukhbarat, or whatever drives them, are monsters. And the abuse of human beings is infamous. And you make it very clear that there are no limits. Again and again, you come up against villains worrying about losing their soul, or I've lost my soul. The despair is here. So your lessons learned, David, having pulled the virtuous American gambler through all of this, does it touch a character to spend so much of his energy going up against monsters? Did you think about Sam in his relationship towards Syria? It made me feel now and again reading the book soiled, as if, why am I here? What am I doing? This is deviltry, and I'm in Hades.
Well, I think, you know, the book was really born out of some emotional processing that I was doing when I left the agency about what I had seen and experienced working on Syria at that time. And I wanted that raw feeling to be there. I wanted it to be told not just through the eyes of a CIA officer, although we certainly have that, but to be told, you know, and really experienced by the reader through the eyes of multiple Syrians who were experiencing this war differently and who, you know, do things that are, as happened in the war and continues to happen in the war, do very despicable things to other people and to each other. I really wanted to capture, I think, the bravery and heroism that I saw in the conflict, and also to bring out the inhumanity and the tragedy that I saw there. And that icky feeling at times was one that I felt like was important, because I wanted the book to some degree to just feel true to the Syria that I had lived through, and that the Syrians lived through in that time period. And I think that to feel that you are with each of those characters, even they're very clear villains, and, you know, there's bad guys and there's good guys in this book. It is a spy thriller, but even the bad guys, I want you to understand why they're doing what they're doing, even though we can all say what they're doing is despicable. I want to bring them to life and make them feel real, not kind of like paper thin wind up, you know, demons, but to be real people. And, you know, you said earlier, Sam, you know, he makes this horrible mistake. I wanted my good guys and good girls to, you know, be real and to do things that real people do, which is they make mistakes. So I think we get sort of, I hope that the reader comes away with some sense of, you know, we're walking through the full gamut of human experience here. And the lens on that is the war and the CIA.
Final detail. We have a little more than a minute, David. There is a wall in the CIA headquarters at Langley of officers who've died in duty. There is a fictional death in your book. What is that wall? You've seen it. I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's our memorial wall. It's in the lobby. Used to be the lobby that everyone would walk through, but now it's a little bit, you know, it's not as trafficked because it's not as close to the parking lots. But there's a wall with the stars. There's a book of honor that has, you know, the stars and the names, at least the ones that can be printed. And it's a very reverential place for every CIA officer, because those are the people who have, you know, made the ultimate sacrifice. And it is a profound experience to walk by that and to look at those names. And it's why in my book, there is the death of a case officer, and there is a profound and deep desire on the part of the CIA officers in my book to avenge that death, which is how the agency feels.
David McCloskey, the book is Damascus Station. It is a work of fiction. We're not settling the world of the Middle East. We're describing a thriller, highly enjoyable, but at the same time, the background is sorrow. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.